This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello everybody, welcome to a brand new episode of Extended. My name's Gareth Stringer, I'm the Executive Editor of Global Aviation Resource. I haven't been here for ages, so I persuaded the guys to let me host tonight's show. And when I say the guys, I am of course talking about the Royal Aeronautical Society's Tim Robinson.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. Good to be here again.
Nice to see you. Nice to hear you.
You're in the pilot seat.
I am in the captain's seat tonight.
We're merely passengers in the back.
We'll call you the first officer, but we can't do it without our flight engineer, XTP Media's Peter Johnson. Peter, how are you?
I'm absolutely fine, Gareth. Great to have you back. We've missed you desperately, and I know some of the listeners have also gently been prodding us to make sure you come back.
Was that so, my dad, was it?
your mum, actually.
Does anyone have flight engineers anymore? Tim, you'll probably know that, won't you?
Yep. The 727 that was at Farnborough.
Ah, there you go.
Had a flight engineer.
There's got to be some of those. There's got to be some old clunker still flying around.
Yeah.
And there's the odd, I think the odd DC-10 still in the air, isn't there? So
There we go. As ever, we're going to start with a little bit of news, and then we've got hopefully something nice to talk about that we want all of you guys to contribute to on social media, etc. afterwards. Let's start with the news. Tim, I'm going to come to you first with a trivia question. What's 25 million pounds, 302 feet long, and will be able to fly unmanned for 5 days?
Is it an airship?
It might be. What a fantastic story. Let's talk Airlander. I was genuinely very excited about this, and I'm sure you were as well.
Yeah. Okay. So obviously the big news, if you've been on Mars or you've not been watching, is the longest aircraft in the world has actually taken flight. So this is the Airlander 10 from Hybrid Air Vehicles, Cardington, Bedford. It's flown before. It is worth pointing that out as the U.S. Army's LEMF back in the day. And it's now being kind of rebuilt and modified by the people who developed the whole kind of hybrid airship concept. And they finally kind of got into the air. Very, very short flight at the end of the day, but it was good for photographers. They had that kind of golden hour for making it look good. So that flew on the 17th of August. So now what happens is, a lot of flight testing to do. They've got about sort of 200 hours of flight testing, and it's still going to be operating under a permit to fly sort of a regime with EASA. So you're not going to be able to go on there and book passenger flights sort of straight away. But what they are going to be doing is they're going to be pretty busy doing kind of demo flights. I wasn't there at the first flight, but I was talking with the CEO couple of days previously, and he sort of said that they'd had sort of phenomenal interest from around the world. They were talking to kind of defense militaries and also civil customers. So that is the next once they get the sort of flight testing through, that's the next sort of stage for them, is to go and do these customer demonstrations and for people to sort of see what it really can do and for an airship. There is this giggle factor of, it looks like a big bomb, et cetera, et cetera. you know, it wasn't, you know, Zeppelins So, but one thing, it did sort of strike me that, you know, people say, well, you know, would you put an ISR package on it? Could you do it to surveillance? And one thing that sort of did strike me, and I mentioned this on Twitter, was hearing a lot about things like, you know, drone swarms these days and the idea of using a C-130 or something like that, or even fighter jets to deploy micro drones and, you know, you send these things off, whether they're little fixed-wing drones or multicopters or whatever. But then, if it's a fixed-wing aircraft, you've got a problem of how do you get the things back on board? Now, if you've got something like an airlander, you know, and this just occurred to me that it just kind of floats around very, very slowly. You could theoretically have it as a sort of a mothership that could launch and recover drones, you know, recharge them, 3D print them. You know, that would be, I mean, it's kind of like some of the old airship ideas of the 1930s, you know, the USS Macon. But, you know, that is a unique kind of niche that I don't think you could really do with a manned aircraft, or sorry, a fixed-wing aircraft, you know, flying at high speed. I don't think there'd be some sort of technological challenges to getting drones back aboard, you know, a fast-moving, yeah, you know, fixed-wing aircraft. I don't know. Food for thought.
Peter, did you watch it? I mean, it really seemed to capture everyone's imagination. I don't know about you. I was watching. There was one chap broadcasting on Periscope through Twitter, and his battery ran out about 5 minutes before it took off. So I, like a lot of other people, was suddenly, has anyone got a link? And I think eventually watched it on Facebook. Did you manage to catch it?
I didn't catch it live, but I think I didn't catch the video live, but I caught some of the tweets on Twitter, and it just captured everyone's imagination. I don't know if it was a slow news day or whatever, but everyone got really captivated by it, and I was quite surprised, I got to say, because it didn't really, apart from Tim really talking about it a lot, I hadn't really seen or heard much, and I think once they launched, it really stole the show. So really exciting. Tim, one of the things that I suppose I can't get my head round is the weather challenges for this and what conditions it can and can't operate in. We saw it obviously on a very calm day, and you know, I'm sure that the flight testing will start proving its capabilities, but what sort of challenges will it have? I mean, this part of the world isn't very very good for staying particularly wind free. I mean, look at it, August, and we had 60 mile an hour winds this week where I live.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you talk to the hybrid air vehicles, what they'll say is that they, you know, they realize that obviously there's more weather restrictions in some ways than you know, fixed wing aircraft. You know, you on the ground, you can leave it outside, you can, it does sort of swing into the wind, you know, you have it on a mooring mast and it will kind of rotate, and it's the outside kind of the outside material is very, very durable indeed, you know, very high tech sort of spacesuit type spaceflight type quality material. So I don't think it's kind of a thing on the ground, but yeah, they basically likened it, said, you know, it'd be like ocean going yacht avoiding storms. You know, you'd have to have that sort of. So it's got, I think it's got a weather radar on it, and you'd have to have that sort of. Which, you know, in the fixed wing world, you know, if there is a, you know, huge big thunderstorm ahead, and you know, you go around it.
Right. Okay.
I think there'll just need to be that little bit more thinking ahead, and awareness, and maybe kind of planning around the weather, taking the weather into account.
And Tim, how does this compare with the US based aircraft that are being developed there?
Okay, well, Lockheed Martin, obviously they're working on a they've got their own sort of freight project. Now they're going straight to the freight idea. I think it's about sort of 50 tons is the sweet spot. So they're going straight. And I think also Lockheed are going for the probably optionally manned. It might even be unmanned, actually. You know, they signed an MOU for I think some company in the UK that's interested in getting some. Hybrid air vehicles with Airlander, they're going the smaller route first. So Airlander 10 is looking at sort of things like first off, we've got tourism, aerial tourism, surveillance, patrol, sensor test bed, maybe things like that. Civil type missions. And then they're talking about the Airlander 50, which would be the cargo sort of airship, which is a bit more challenging because if you go to the cargo airship, you've got to start thinking about the ground infrastructure a lot more. You know, how are you going to get the cargo? The Airlander can land anywhere, which is a big thing compared to previous generations of airships that were tried. But it's right. Okay, so, you know, a port or an airport has got all this, the cargo. It's all very well synchronized and organized and seamless. How do you do that for an airship?
Yeah. Interesting. I'm quite excited. I'm really quite excited because it's a great British technology, and good luck to the guys. Yeah. And really excited to see it succeed.
Definitely. I mean, if you don't try, you don't get anywhere.
No, exactly. Exactly. A completely different subject now. We're just going to step back a little bit to the first week of August, 3rd of August, I believe it was. Peter, we had this extraordinary sight of an Emirates Boeing 777 that had a crash landing in Dubai. 300 people on board, 282 passengers, 18 crew. Sadly, but amazingly, a firefighter was killed, but nobody else was killed. But one of the things that came out from that extraordinary incident was videos and photos of passengers collecting their luggage, walking across the concrete with their luggage having been evacuated from the aircraft. And this has sparked quite a big discussion, hasn't it? I mean, I think firstly we should say, I think most of us were probably aghast that people would do that, for starters. But there's been a lot of chat, hasn't there?
Yeah, it's really been going round and round. I think there's a couple of things that come out of this story in particular. I think the first thing, before the aircraft even touched down, from the initial reports, the aircraft came down, all was well. There was no sign of any trouble. Then the aircraft lifted off and then came crashing down to Earth, which, for those individuals who think they're very clever and can undo their seatbelts around that time, that proved a gentle reminder not to do that. But as you say, all passengers and crew escaped the aircraft and escaped within the targeted times. I think it was 90 seconds, I think, Tim, or something like that. They were out very quickly and all were safe. There were some minor injuries from the chutes. Sadly, one firefighter did lose his life, which is very, very sad, and I'm sure that needs looking into. But of course, we then all watched on social media as this unfolded, and picture after picture and video after video came from the scene of people leaving the aircraft with trolleys, carrying laptops and all sorts of things. So the challenge really is, when is this going to stop? Because although I think everyone luckily got out of that aircraft, this can't continue. And it opens the door to the debate, which has really, really grown legs. And that is, should the overhead bins be locked automatically and unlocked, maybe by the pilots, I would imagine, with the seatbelt signs or something like that? And there's been a frenzy of debate about whether this is good or bad, or I want my luggage and so forth. But I suppose the question I want to pose to everyone is, we can all sit there as Monday morning quarterbacks and say we wouldn't do that. But if your iPad was just there, and or your handbag or your camera bag or something like that, wouldn't we all do it? And I genuinely, after some search to think how I'd respond in those circumstances, I'd like to think I'd do the right thing. But I think a lot of people are realizing that in this day and age, the approach to life seems to be a very selfish one. So grab all you can and get out. But How much longer can it continue before we see on social media the live scenes of people being injured or worse from, you know, their bags falling down the chute, bursting the chute? That's the other thing, you know, luggage, it's rough-edged, and some of them were carrying trolley bags. Ripped the chute, and the people behind would have had no chance because that aircraft was absolutely burnt out completely, and you would never have survived that. So I think it opens up quite a lot of issues. I think some of the regulatory authorities are starting to revisit those. But is it a cultural thing? I'd suggest that we're so attuned now to grabbing everything we want that most people will still do it. So how do we stop it? Well, we stop it by locking the bins, I suppose.
Tim, there's a piece in the BBC. We'll put a link on the show notes. But fire safety expert from Greenwich University said that the idea of locking the overhead bins until the aircraft reaches the gate, I'll read you the quote. It says, "The idea has fallen on stony ground. Airlines think it will be unpopular with passengers."
Yeah, I mean, there could be something in that. Interestingly, Russia's new UAC, well, it's the MC-21 airliner. It's their answer to the A320 Neo or the 737 Max. That is offering lockable overhead bins as an option, and that they're going to be controlled by the the cabin crew or the purser or what have you. I think it's difficult because if you start doing that, are people going to be spending more time kind of trying to open them and therefore blocking the exits instead of getting out? Are people going to be going there and you know, you can imagine something where some passenger had their heart medicine or something, you know, or there's some kind of vital medicine or baby medicine put in the overhead, and that's locked, and then you know, the airline will get into trouble about that. I don't know. Or it could just be a matter of, better education, but, you know, more emphasis on leave your luggage in the in-flight safety videos. I mean, there's so much money sort of spent on those safety videos. Maybe that is one approach to kind of educating people a bit more and trying to kind of convince them that maybe it's a good idea to just leave your stuff behind. Also, I think you've hit the nail on the head a little bit, Peter, on would we do it? And, these people are terrible. And then you know, you get on the plane with your, on a work trip with your laptop, and you're thinking, you know, well, that's it. I'm not over my dead body. I'm going to kind of hand this over to go in the baggage, the whole luggage, because this is so maybe what also the airlines could do is maybe there is there's that fear that when you do get separated from your luggage, it doesn't always come back straight away, or the airlines, there's still a whole load of sort of missing luggage or kind of foul ups in that. So maybe there's something to be done by airlines and luggage manufacturers or passengers, or, I don't know, getting all together. And if you had something like RFID chip tracking, that's easy to do now. You could have that on your smartphone. Your baggage, if you got off there and you knew, they've got the aircraft's burned, as we've got off there, it was a false alarm. We've all disembarked. I left my bag on there, but I know exactly where it is. I'll go and get it. That would might be the technological solution to reassuring people that, do leave your stuff on here. Get out first. It's safety first. But if it turns out it's a false alarm, or it's something that doesn't really result in the loss of the aircraft, loss of the your luggage, you will be able to get your luggage back quickly.
Yeah, I think there's some other issues as well, and that is those in the industry understand the challenges. We as enthusiasts or however else we're involved in the industry understand the challenges, and it's the general public, and there has to be a way of educating them better, or dare I say it, frightening them. I spent a very, very short bit of time when I went to visit our very good friends at Eventfire Solutions and had the opportunity to put a very small fire out, and it was frightening. It was absolutely frightening. And I'm sure Tony and Paul would have comments to make about a fire on board an aircraft with all that fuel and other flammables around. And as I said, you know, if I was standing at the door waiting to jump, 30 feet, something like that, to safety, and someone in front of me had dragged their trolley down and ripped the chute or something, or blocked the chute, I'm either going to burn or break something, or worse, trying to escape. And of course, you know, there's going to be people behind me as well. And, you know, you then start to think of, you know, the women and children, or people who are less abled. And, you know, something's got to change here. Something's got to change. This cannot go on. Thank God, whichever God you pray to, that everyone got out of that aircraft. But sadly, as we say, you know, a firefighter lost his life. So let's not see any more of this. Sense has to prevail, but I think sense has to be beaten into some people.
Yeah. Moving on to a little bit of military news before we wrap up this section. Tim, talk to us a little bit about the USTAF's TX program. They've been developing or looking at ideas to replace the T-38 since 2003, believe it or not, but we are just beginning to get a little look at what sort of the aircraft might be.
Yeah, I mean, very exciting in the just in the past few days. This is the big competition to supply the USAF with its next advanced trainer, really replace the T-38 Talon, which is going since 50 years. And two prototypes have just kind of been emerged or been teased. One was a Northrop TX prototype that's been worked on by Scaled Composites. That was spotted on the doing taxiing tests at Mojave in California. Looks a bit like a sort of a single engined T-38. Interesting. The other ones, other teams in the bidding are Raytheon. They've got the T-100, which is the Leonardo Aramaki M346 Master. That was at the Farnborough earlier in July. Lockheed Martin's got the KIA Lockheed Martin T-50 Golden Eagle, modified version of that. And there's also a very secretive Boeing Saab design as well, and Boeing has actually teased a little bit more about theirs. So the nose of that, and I think a sort of like a little head-on view as well. They're playing it very, very cagey, but yeah, it's interesting now to obviously the competition sort of hotting up, and we're seeing some more images released and you know, come out of it. Interestingly, actually, BAE is teamed with Northrop on their bid. So there is some people actually in the UK with experience from Hawk working on you know, helping out Northrop with their bid.
Interesting. Work clearly moving forward to see which aircraft is going to replace the venerable T-38. And I think I'm just reading Boeing and Saab holding a media day on September the 13th. So by the time we reconvene to record again, we'll probably know even more. So we'll keep an eye on that one. Before we move on, and I know that Peter and Tim will be nodding away in agreement, we just wanted to take a moment. We've just passed the 12-month mark since the terrible, terrible accident at the Shoreham Air Show. And, of course, the thoughts of all of us at Extended are with everybody involved, and however they were involved and on that day. So we're thinking of you.
Definitely.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups, which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures, and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
So for this next section, I want to talk briefly about Skies Above Britain. It was a TV, it's episode one of, I believe, a five programme series. It aired here in the UK last week. And it really encapsulated. Episode one was called Flying Into Danger. We had typhoons doing practice intercepts. We had air traffic controllers dealing with unidentified aircraft. We had search and rescue. We then had a young trainee typhoon pilot flying the aircraft for the first time. So before I go on to talk about the sort of passion for aviation that it really encapsulated, Peter, I'll come to you first. Did you watch it? What did you think?
I really enjoyed it, actually. It was nothing like I thought it was going to be. It was very different. I thought it was just going to be all about air traffic controllers, which I was up for. But it was very spicy. It was a bit different. Some great footage of civil and military aircraft. I loved it. I loved seeing behind the scenes and how things operated. And although sometimes we sort of sit back and say, yeah, we know all that, it's lovely to see it in action. I thought Swanwick, which is our main, the UK's main air traffic control centre, I thought looked fantastic. It was great to see inside and see how it operated. I was trying to fit all the screens together to say, who's doing what? Is he doing that area? Is he doing approaches? Is she covering this? I was also trying to, sadly, recognise the voices of the controllers from my days of gently listening in. We're not allowed to republish them here in the UK, but slightly familiar voices. Great to put a face to a voice. So I really, really enjoyed it, and I thought, good on them, because we really need some positive things said about the aerospace and aviation industry. We need kids watching things like that to start saying, gosh, I want to do that. I can do that. I want to sit in that centrifuge, you know, and go around up to 9Gs or whatever it may be. We've got to find some ways of engaging the young engineers and the future pilots. And I thought this was what a great way of doing it. And sadly, it was a bit late for that, but I thought, good on them.
Tim, you work in the aviation industry day in, day out. How did it make you feel seeing some of this stuff?
Yeah, it showed the variety of things that were going on in the skies above, which you don't always kind of get. You know, sometimes it sort of tends to be, oh, right, you know, air traffic control, it's all airliners. And so that was really good. And, you know, one of the standout things that I thought, you know, great program altogether, really, really interesting, you know, great for getting people interested in aviation. But, whoa, that S-92 rescue.
Yeah.
In.
Oh yeah!
I
God.
Could not believe
yeah.
it.
Yeah,
you know the
feet from the cliff face, wasn't it?
Yeah,
the rotors
in 00 conditions and a winch crew and the crew of getting that close. That was you know. One thing was bizarre was I read a review a day after or something, and I think it was on the Guardian. I'm going to call them out on this anyway. I don't care. but they said, oh, you know, nothing really happened. There was no drama. I was like, wow. were they watching the same program as I was?
That was like sweaty palms watching that.
Yeah. I will be honest. I had the bedclothes up against my face when he said, how far away? And he said, feet. I thought, oh, God. I mean, they must be okay, but, yeah, this was some
he
very dramatic.
Like, it's jobs like this that make me wish I was still at home.
Yes.
Or something like that. And there was some witticism came from the cockpit.
And I genuinely thought, thank God for people like that. Thank God there are people out there who will do that sort of thing. Because God forbid I'm ever in a place like that, that I need that assistance. I know there's people who will do everything possible to get to you. Because, I mean, you've got to look at it and say, you know, how did that happen? And, you know, it was very remote and all that sort of stuff. That's a different issue. You've just got to hope that there's people like that in the emergency services. Because remember, it's a Coast Guard helicopter, wasn't it? And it was deep in land. So, you know, that was interesting as well and playing on my mind and thinking, well, where's the dividing lines? How does this work? You know, what is the governance here that says the Coast Guard should do this? Which I thought was quite interesting. Don't know if you've got any views on that, but I was like, oh, is this the Coast Guard's job? I suppose who else is?
If no one else can get there, I suppose, then, No, it was interesting. But, I mean, it got a huge thumbs up from me as well. But it really got me thinking because I thought the other thing it did very well in all of the segments, whether it was the Tsar, the Typhoon, the stuff at Nats, Nick and Giles English from Braemon who were on, is it encapsulated their passion for aviation. And the three of us are all sitting here recording this, and we have done for however many episodes it is now, 60-odd. It must be 60-odd.
This is 64.
Wow, okay. Because we've got a huge passion for aviation, and I thought, actually, I wonder how Tim got into all of this. I wonder how Peter got into all of this. So that's what I thought we'd spend a few minutes talking about, and we would love, if you're listening to this, for you to drop us a tweet or our Facebook, and obviously you can find the details on the site, and tell us where did your passion come from, and what is your passion for aviation. So Tim, I'm going to come to you first. Where did it all start for you? What are your first aviation memories?
Okay, so no one not really kind of I suppose it was transmitted via my dad. He was very keen. He wasn't in the Air Force, but he was very keen on. He built model aircraft, control line aircraft, plastic models, and he took me to air shows. I've got a very, very clear memory of being in a pushchair or something, and being taken to Shuttleworth, and being given like a balsa wood, you know, like the little ones you had in the little packs, you know, the plastic packs, and being able to kind of like, you know, wind that up and you know, probably eventually break it. And then there was a bit where I was in hospital again. That must have been very young, and I got probably a frog. This is a brand name. A frog.
I was wondering where this was going to.
LA5 plastic kit. To kind of, you know, keep me occupied. So I think he probably brought some glue in, and I had an LA5 to kind of make while I was in hospital. So that was a kind of like, you know, started off. You know, obviously went to help my dad out with models, got into plastic modelling, and then also I read a lot. You know, voracious reader, and you know, Biggles. He had had a few sort of like, you know, modelling books and history, you know, history of aviation books and books to it. So the Biggles books as well were a big, sort of inspiration, I suppose, or something like that, you know. Here I am. You know, I've got pretty cool job, and I get to kind of write about stuff that, you know, I'd sort of dreamed about as a kid.
I'm going to come back to you, but first, Peter, how about you? Where did it all where did this bug start for you?
Well, I suppose I've I've talked a lot about my dad and the influence of my father. What I'm going to talk about now, actually, is how I fell out of love with aviation and then sort of came back to it. Because I think a lot of people know my dad was in the Fleet Air Arm, and I suppose I looked very much up to that. But I sort of fell out of love with aviation. I was a plane spotter. I was a photographer. I was a get on anything, go to any airport. And then I had to go and do a job that saw me fly a lot. And in my in the 6 or 7 years that I did this job, I flew an awful lot. And I enjoyed it because I've always enjoyed wanting to be up there. And I do still have that craving that I will literally fly in anything that I can fly in, as long as it's safe. I'm not crazy, but I'll go if anyone offers a flight. I will go if I can. And I had a job that helped me do that, and it was quite interesting listening to the interview with Paul in the last episode, because I'd love to be in that place now, but I did have that sort of job before, and it actually, I became disillusioned with flying the airlines. It became dull, it became monotonous, and because it was my job, I lost the passion for it. And and that drifted on, and I did my usual, you know, I tried to go and recreate it by doing my PPL, and there's some interesting stories that are around on social media about that, which was great. But I even lost my passion for that as well. And I tell you what got me back into flying is podcasts. And not my podcast with you guys. It was. You did it. I was just having a bad time in life and searching for something to entertain me. And my wife said to me, for goodness sake, will you do something for you? Go and find something. And I thought, anything I like is flying. And there's not really much. I don't want to go and sit at an airport. But I went down and visited Popham Airfield and had a wander around, saw the big Antonov down there. And I thought, I do still love this. And I went to Farnborough. And just before I went to Farnborough in 2010, I think it was, I started looking around for a bit of information and came across the Airplane Geeks, and that was it. Every week I listened into those guys and I thought, God, they're just so passionate. This is what I used to be like. And it just reignited my passion. A different platform, a different way of expressing it. And that was it. And I'm a very different enthusiast to the enthusiast I was when I was younger. I'm very excited about books, and that's, you know, and the work that Simon does on the Enthusiasts Book Club on Facebook is absolutely brilliant. If you're not on there, I know some people don't like Facebook, but these are the reasons why some of these things are great, because there's fantastic people on there who share books, who share write-ups. It's just such an engaged audience. There's no egos in there. It's right. Such a fantastic, and that's reignited my interest in aviation books. So I suppose I express that passion in a different way now. I love doing this. I love doing this job. It's taken me to such wonderful places, and more importantly, met just the greatest people around, and of course you two aside, I've met some great people I'm happy to call my friends, and I've met them through this, and that's made it so much better. So what do I like now? I love the sound, I love the smell of aircraft, jet fuel. I love to see them in all shapes and sizes. I used to go to Heathrow when I was younger and be bored by the sight of the Tridents and the BAC 111s and the TriStars and the DC-10s and the DC-8s and the DC-9s, and they're all gone. And so I miss that now. So I enjoy watching anything fly now, because it still baffles me how 300 tons gets in the air and flies halfway around the world. And then, and here's my parting shot, the thing that sums it up for me is last week I was driving home. I was, 2 miles from my house, and I saw a Chinook go over at very low altitude, maybe 200 feet, something like that. And my phone started ringing, and it was my wife. And the Chinook had seen my wife and my daughter in my garden, turned around, flew back, dipped its back. The guy waved at my daughter in the garden and did another turn. The pilot waved and then flew off. So a massive, massive thank you to 27 Squadron at RAF Odeon, Vortex 469. Thank you very much, because that absolutely made my daughter's day. She couldn't stop talking about it. She was so excited about it. And that's what we need to do. We need, just need to ignite that passion. And we can't go on the cockpits of airliners anymore. So it's things like that that just mean so much more to me now than collecting numbers and taking photographs, you know. I was going to say how many years ago, but a long time ago. So,
Peter, I was just going to say, was it a hot day that the Chinook visited?
It was.
Was your wife wearing a bikini in the back garden?
Well, I should have known that was coming, and I did sort of think that.
I just wondered whether there might have been an ulterior motive for a Chinook to come back and do a recon.
I could get into very, very big trouble here, couldn't I? But I have my suspicions. Let's put it like that.
Tim, one question. I've got a different sort of full-time job now, so I'm not writing anywhere near as much as I would like to, although I am planning to get back into that as much as possible. But one thing a lot of people have often sort of said to me is, when you're involved with it that much and you're writing about it so much, can you still be an enthusiast? How do you put a line between those two things, or do you feel that there shouldn't be any line between those two things, being a sort of professional and an enthusiast, if that's the right way of making the distinction?
That is a very good question. That was on the tip of my tongue to ask us all that. I mean, that's a very good question. Do we give aviation? Do we give aerospace? Do we give it a free pass? Are we uncritical of it a little bit? I know people. There are people who have similar jobs than I, and they say, you know, we're not advocates. You know, have no interest in it. No passion for it. They go home, presumably switch off, they want to do something else. I don't know. If you're an enthusiast, I think you can separate the two, and you can approach it critically. But I think having that sort of enthusiast, but wanting to know more, you're always wanting to increase your knowledge. And if you've been immersed in it or read about it since you were young, you're gonna have that background where you are gonna make these connections and, you know, somehow, I won't say you'd have an advantage, maybe that's the wrong word, because, some people just treat it as a business. You know, it's just business journalism, but whatever, instead of them writing about, train companies, it's aeroplane companies. Yeah. But if you have got this passion, then I think, you're going to draw on that vast base of knowledge, and you're going to read more about it. And the more you read about it, the more you discover. And the more you discover, the more you want to read more about it, and so on. And also, I think it's important actually in all the people in aerospace. And this seems to be sort of just for aviation and aerospace are all. You get the one or two that aren't, but it's very passionate as well.
It is, Tim. Absolutely right. It's a sector that tends to encourage that, isn't it?
Yeah. So, you wouldn't know this for the podcast, but I'm actually quite shy. So for going into a kind of a crowded room and talking to lots of VIPs and some of these people have got vastly amount, you're kind of wow, you know, these people have, you know, when I first started the job and even today now, you know, you think wow, these people have got like years of experience, they've done so much, they've flown this, they've been here, they've been in that battle, wow, you know, how do I even go on their level, you know, or talk to them? And then it's having that spark of going up to someone and saying, you know, and just chatting and finding out, oh yeah, yeah, oh, what's your favorite aircraft or what's your favorite airline or did you know that? And once that you've got that connection, you know, you find that the industry is absolutely filled with people who are just, you know, as passionate and you know, even if they leave the industry temporarily, somehow they will find a way back into another guys. Yeah. And I don't think you could sort of say that for, I don't know, accountancy or any accountants listening, but there is that kind of draw to it. It's still a sexy industry. It's still something that the people like to kind of say, yeah, I'm in aviation, or I'd like to be in aviation. And that helps in making connections and making contacts and relating to people and getting stories out of them, is that they go, oh yeah, this person is on our side, you know, on our wavelength.
Yeah. Tim, let me just pose something to you then about that discussion, because it was very relevant to me a few weeks ago when we were at Farnborough, actually, and I wasn't having the best of weeks for lots of unrelated reasons. And going to Farnborough that day, when I left and got in the car, didn't feel like a very happy moment for me. But it wasn't helped by the fact that Farnborough is pretty wet this year as well. It was pretty dreary when I got there. But, you know, we met up, we started chatting. I saw you talking to your colleagues and I thought, oh, this is quite exciting, actually. There's a plan. There's things are happening. And we went into the first interview and I think you asked me, are you going to lead or do you want me to start? And I thought, do you know what? I just cannot even get the first words out of my mouth. And you started that discussion and that was it. For the rest of the day, we were just swamped with interviews, content and people talking to us. And it was so exciting. And that point you just made there about being shy, bizarrely or not, you can believe this or not, so am I. But the one thing that really opens me up and wants me to learn more, a bit like you were saying before, is listening to people talk about aviation, about space, about aerospace, and the stories that they've got and the experiences they've had. It just sort of drags us in. It just drags me in for certain. So a big thank you for you for supporting me at Farnborough, but you lit the touch paper and withdrew, and I'm back on form now.
No, that's all right. It's you know, we were a good team that day.
No, it was great. I really enjoyed it.
We could have
really
had 20 people that day. We wouldn't have covered everything.
Yeah. It was amazing. And, you know, think things like experiencing, I suppose, aviation through somebody else is how I got into it. I hope we're giving people a little bit of that experience as well by some of the content we're bringing, not necessarily this, but some of the interviews we bring and some of the people we get to that are not always that easy to get to. And we've got some great guests lined up, so, you know, hopefully the show goes on and you know, other people will get hooked in as well. But for me, Gareth, one of the things, and we need to come back and get your story, by the way. We also need to talk about is how do we get some of those youngsters and younger people into the industry? Because our view, and, you know, Tim mentioned modelling and things like that, that's becoming fewer and farther between now, with social media being so dominant in our lives. How do we, I suppose, bring the next generations through?
Drones.
Yeah, probably. I think that's something that worries me. I mean, you've both mentioned things that were equally, you know, very, very important to me growing up. I mean, again, it was my dad. My dad was in the Air Force. He was in one of the last groups of people in the UK to do national service in 1958. He was a instrument technician on Victor B1s when they entered service at RAF Cottesmore he was with 15 Squadron, 10 Squadron were based there as well. And, he actually signed up and did an extra 12 months in the Air Force. He above and beyond what he needed to do for his national service, and he stayed interested, and as you said, Tim, I have sort of incredible, very brief but quite precise recollections of being at shows as a real youngster, where I've got almost like little snippets of clarity. I can't remember the sort of big picture. I couldn't tell you about the whole day or anything like that, but I can remember them. And it, you know, it was air shows, and it was, books were massive for me. And I was a prodigious reader, as you said, Tim. I still am. And I built Airfix models and stuff. And I just look at, you know, 12-year-olds now, whatever, you know, my nephews, you know, I love them both to bits, but they're not sitting at home reading books and building models and stuff like that, because, and that's be really alien to them. I think they'd love an air show, don't get me wrong, and maybe air shows are, I believe, are a huge part of how we engage with the younger generation. They have to be, but some of it has gone, and I'm not sure we'll get it back.
No, it is, the point about air shows is a critical one, because we've talked about it an awful lot over the last year or two, but obviously, you know, Shoreham has had a dramatic effect on current air shows and probably what will happen in the future. You know, I live in a part of the world that has a public display down at Bournemouth. Sadly, the weather, those very high winds, were too challenging for one of the days. And interestingly, on social media, it wasn't the enthusiasts, it wasn't the people like me, it was the general public saying, oh, it's so sad, you know, we're not going to get to see it. And I thought, gosh, what a missed opportunity. And it was quite refreshing to see so many, quote-unquote, air quotes, ordinary people so excited by an air show. And, you know, they're getting so much harder to put on now. Luckily, Bournemouth's over the sea, so, you know, slightly different challenges for them. But, you know, if we don't have those air shows, we won't be bringing, you know, your nephews and nieces through, because they just won't be there to see it. They can't go on the cockpits, to the cockpit while the aircraft is flying. They can go when it's touched down and closed down and shut down and not quite as exciting. You know, the view for me from the pilot's perspective, when I went to that first cockpit when I was, I don't know, 11 on a 707 across the Atlantic, was just like, oh my God, this is it. You know, I've made it. This is what I want to do. This is where I want to be. This is what I want to be interested in. And we can't do that anymore. And if we lose air shows, which we're starting to do, it's going to be tragic for the future of the industry, because not everything is going to be able to be designed on an iPad or a tablet or whatever comes next, you know.
Tim, do you have to do the corporate part of it as part of your role? What's your opinion? Are corporates doing enough that visibly to engage with youngsters? You know, STEM is a massive thing now, but, you know, not just for aviation. It's a big thing, full stop. But what's your feel about maybe the sort of next 15, 20 years, perhaps?
Yeah, I think you know, you've got all the big companies, and you know, any big company worth their salt will have an outreach program. They'll have, you know, they'll devote, you know, significant resources to going out and sort of spreading the word and trying to get people young people interested in apprenticeships, careers, science, and all the rest of it. You know, you only have to look at things like the techno zone in Riyadh, or the Futures Day in Farnborough on the Friday. However, I think that there's a couple of things there, and firstly, it's the big companies. So perhaps people miss out that there are a lot of small, medium enterprises that are looking for skilled engineers, looking for people interested in aerospace. So it tends to be dominated by the big names. And also, it's very localized. In that, if you are lucky enough to say you live near in the catchment area of Broughton or Filton or Preston, somewhere near Wharton, you're going to have that growing up. You're going to be, BA Systems are just around the corner, and that's where they make the Typhoons, and that will be in your on your horizon anyway, as that's a possible career thing, whether I want to fly the Typhoon or whether I want to help build it or design cabs or what have you. So it's very kind of localized, and some areas obviously well covered and other areas are not. So I think that those are two points I'd had. I would have two hopes for the future. We've mentioned air shows, obviously. I did mention, obviously, I did sort of say jokingly drones. And I think that is interesting. There was an interesting article talking about someone who is a GA pilot who had been out flying a drone for the first time on a beach and with a friend. And he had he said that the amount of interest that UAVs or quadcopters in getting kids air-minded and starting, and he said he was hearing a lot of things back of people saying, I'd flown the drone around, enjoy it. How do I fly a real aircraft?
Yeah.
So that was interesting. He was saying, and I think the article was in fact titled, could drones save GA?
Tim, that's interesting. But I suppose, I mentioned starting on the PPL route and got well through that. But unless you've got a good flying school that's relatively cheap, it's just an insurmountable goal for most people, isn't it? Going through that journey, unless you get sponsored again by one of the big companies. I'm not saying it was cheaper a decade or two ago, but it was a hell of a lot cheaper than it is now. And I'm just thinking, if one of my boys wanted to embark upon their PPL, what would we be looking at? 8,000-10,000, maybe a bit more. I mean, I spent 5,500, maybe 6,000 getting as far as my qualifying cross country, and that was 40 odd hours, and that was 15 years ago. So there's a real challenge, and we've tried to bring some coverage from some local airfields because people have gently prompted us to try and ignite the passion at those sorts of places. But I'll be really honest, our listeners haven't really bitten at that. So what's the appetite? We all want to see Typhoons fly. We all want to see, A380s thrown around the skies at air shows and things like that. But, unless we support those grassroots, those pilots and those engineers are not coming from this part of the world for sure. So it's a real challenge. And by the way, I just want a quick mention to Mark Maiden, who's a very, very good supporter of the show. Sorry, Mark, I missed the fact you'd passed your flight test. He's a newly qualified PPL, so well done, Mark Maiden. Fantastic guy, really, really energetic about the sector, and passed his what Americans would call general flight test, I suppose, a few weeks ago. So well done, Mark.
Yeah. Well done, Mark. And Mark, you're part of a little family that I feel like we've got now. There's Mark and Neil and Joe Ayres. There's loads of people who regularly listen to us and get back to us. And I guess we've been, you look at some of the guests we've had on, we've been so lucky. Mm. And hopefully our passion and enthusiasm for aviation, hopefully that comes through, and hopefully that's part of what I think has helped us attract people to come on. There's no agenda, we just want them to communicate their passion and enthusiasm as well, and that's why we've had everybody from crikey astronauts, RAF pilots, veterans, you know, all sorts. It's been extraordinary. But now let's knock the ball very much into your court. So hopefully you've enjoyed listening to a little bit of why we put you through this. And yeah, come back to us, tell us, and Peter, where's the best place to do that, do you reckon?
Twitter, well, you can Facebook? Do it on Twitter. You'll find us at Aviation Extended, all one word. On Facebook, Aviation Extended, all one word. You can email us on the webpage. You can even leave us a voice message on the webpage. You can click on the box there and leave us a voice message, which will play in the show. So any way you can get that feedback to us. There are some fantastic and very passionate people out there. I know you know who you are. From all around the world, not just in the UK. We've got fantastic followers all around the world. So get in touch and let us know. Let us know what you think.
If you only told us one thing, I don't know if the guys would agree with this. I would love to know what your first aviation memory was.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, yeah, good one.
That'd be quite good fun, I think. Guys, thank you for that. Speaking of feedback, it's a nice segue, wasn't it, Peter?
Very good.
I think we've got a little bit from previous episodes, which, as I wasn't involved, is probably all quite good, isn't it?
Get involved and feedback section of show.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
We have had an awful lot of feedback, but a few bits that I picked out from the last show, we talked with Marissa about airline travel and some of the challenges there. And Ryan O'Connell wrote to us and said, I still don't agree with flight clubs serving booze to the point where it's a problem for the flight crew. And how the hell does someone get past the gates in such an inebriated state? It's a problem here in Australia every now and then. We just had a Jetstar flight bound for Phuket divert to Bali the other day when drunken idiots decided to fight each other. We swapped messages. We talked about altitude affecting things. I think Marissa helped us to better understand that in the last show as well. There's some strong views out there, shall we say.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Also, moving on, Dave Homewood said, I kind of agree with Marissa on the alcohol problem on airlines these days. There are some disgusting things that happens committed by drunken people. However, I think the biggest problem is not a drink or two during a flight. It's the people who go to the airport and get plastered sitting in the airport bar beforehand. And I think we broached this with Marissa, and what she said is the airlines... the airports are driven to raise revenues, and of course the bars are very, very powerful places in airports for raising money, as well as duty free and other things. And so the whole system needs a significant look at to be changed, and unless we start having the bravery to do that, it's not going to change. So thanks very much for that feedback. There were some other areas as well, but we need to probably move on.
Not another flying magazine. The news agents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
We'll be right back.
find this and other great shows at the Aviation Media Network.
TheVoicesInYourHead.com.
We normally finish with some shout outs, and I think we're going to a bit of promoting aerospace, which is something we are equally really passionate about, and I think it's important that we use this as an opportunity to give people a thumbs up and let you know about them, just in case you don't. And I'm usually really poorly prepared for this section, but as I'm the host, I can do mine last this time. So and I have actually got one in mind. So Tim, can I come to you first?
So promoting aerospace. So we said one of my sort of inspirations or how I got into aerospace was reading lots about it. The RAS Aerospace Book Fair is back on 19th of September. Set your diaries out if you're in London that day. Bargain books galore. New and used books from the Aerospace and Aviation Book Fair, not to be missed. Always pick up a few bargains there. It's really really hard to go downstairs and on that day and go in there and see what's what, and go away with not touching your wallet. And also the same day is also Spitfire at 80. That's a Spitfire 80 conference at the RAS, fresh perspectives on an iconic fighter. So that looks quite interesting as well.
Lovely stuff. Peter?
Yeah, I've got a shout out that actually Neil Braden sent on to me. I know we've got a lot of sim fans out there, and Neil's got himself involved with atcprosim.com. He says some of the listeners may be familiar with previous ATC simulators on the PC, such as ATCC and is it Xavius? And ATCS. Tim, this obviously means an awful lot more to you than it does to me. But there's now a new Tracon simulator on the market. Quote from the website, ATC Pro is a new revolutionary simulation written from the ground up and sets the bar really high on the level of realism that's never been seen before. Authentically simulates the Tracon experience, and Neil's very excited to be involved with them. So if you're interested in ATC sims, go over to atcprosim.com and say hello to Neil. He's on social media and a great supporter of the show.
Oh, I see flight sims. There's another thing that I grew up playing. We have covered before, but I think we're going to cover again, aren't we?
Yeah. Well, I think we'll cover again, and this actually might. I mean, we're on a slight diversion here, but I think that actually might. We'll probably go and revisit it. It's a good time to revisit it because virtual reality is here. Yeah. If you're a gamer, you'll know that things like Oculus Rift and the Hive, the hardcore simulation crowd, you need an expensive computer to run it. It's not cheap. The kit itself is not cheap as well. It's not like you can put it on your mobile phone and the stuff that kind of you can just get like a little headset for that. But the people who are trying it out are getting rave reviews, are giving it absolutely, they're saying it is just the best thing you can do with your trousers on. The immersion. I mean, I've experienced virtual reality. I've been, you go to air shows now and everyone's got an Oculus Rift you can try. But a couple of years ago, I tried a Hawk simulator in DCS Hawk, as it was in Duxford, I think it was and this was the early version of Oculus Rift. This was the development kit, and it was a canned flight. I wasn't allowed to control it, but the kind of instinct to kind of reach out and touch these controls, and you're in this kind of cockpit, and you are, you feel the kind of dimensions. You feel how small it is. You've got the ejection seat behind you. You want to grab stuff and touch stuff out. And that was without flying it,
Yeah.
People are reporting, you know, kind of really good stuff. I'm interested to go and sort of trial that and sort of test that myself, give that a bit of a test myself, you know, maybe later on this year and see what it looks like. But that's another way that people could go into, you know, you could get more kids getting interested in aerospace. You know, you put them in something like that, you get Red Bull, for example. Red Bull have got a new PC game out for Red Bull Racing.
Yeah.
They've been trialing it this week at the big game show in Cologne, GamesCon, and they had a whole load of people lined up with VR headsets flying Red Bull Air Race. Now you put kids in that, and their jaws are going to drop.
Yeah.
So
anyway, that's for another show.
I had no idea what you were talking about there, Tim. All those technical terms.
Links will be provided in the show notes.
Yeah. As soon as you mentioned the word computer, Peter switched off there.
Yeah, absolutely.
For a number of reasons, mainly work, sort of health related. It's really not been an air show year for me this year, but I watched on particularly at REAT with great interest, obviously, with the F-35s coming over, and the Air Tattoo just did a fantastic job this year with the lineup of aircraft and sort of pretty much glowing reviews at everyone that went. And to that end, I thought that Tom Gibbons, who heads up the Air Ops team, who are largely responsible for getting the aircraft there in the first place, I think Tom deserves a little bit of a shout out. And best of all, you can find Tom on Twitter as well, at REAT Air Ops. Well done, Tom. Hopefully you're having a little bit of a breather now. I know you're already working on next year's show, which will be an anniversary show for the United States Air Force. So everybody will be waiting. Now that you've got your breath back, we'll be waiting to hear what you're going to pull out of the bag for next year. well done. A huge success. And I think I'm going to pick the DVD up this year, actually, and see everything that I missed. So well done, guys. So that's my shout out. Give Tom a follow and tell him Extended sent you. I think that's about it. It's good to be back.
Just about it. Can I just put a few mentions in for a few people who've flown our flag for us?
Of course you can.
Well, I just want to. I'm often heard droning on about putting some feedback
if you'll excuse the fun.
So a big thank you to Spitfire Mike, who left us some iTunes feedback. Great podcast for any aviation enthusiast, always interested, and great guests, everything from Cessnas to space shuttles. Ewan, thank you very much for your feedback. Fantastic aviation related podcast with a great selection of guests, always worth a listen. And the good old Woodsmeister himself, thank you for your feedback as well. After a bit of a slow start, this podcast has become much slicker in its presentation and is now an eclectic mix of interviews, news and reviews, cutting across all of the aviation industry. So good work. So nice. We've just destroyed all that good work with this episode. Woodsmeister, thank you very much for your feedback. Please do continue to send us that feedback. I know we keep saying it, but it does help us to keep the program active on iTunes and open for others to see it. So the more feedback we get, the better that iTunes will promote the program. So thank you to everyone who's gone up and done that for us.
Absolutely. Tim, remind us where we can find your good self online.
Okay, I'm on Twitter at RESTimR. And the Air Society can be found at www.airsociety.com.
And your good self, Mr. Johnson?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Nascot Hornet, and also often hidden under the Aviation Extended banner on Facebook and Twitter as well. So if you're not following us, give us a follow. We do often get content out in between shows on those platforms as well.
Definitely. Yeah, you can find me at Gareth_Stringer, and everything Gar related is at globalaviationresource.com. Thank you for having me back. It's been far too long, and I've loved every minute of this evening, chap. So thank you for your patience, and I look forward to the next one. But for now, Tim, thank you very much.
Thanks. See you next time.
And thanks to you, Peter.
See you next time.
And it's goodbye from me as well. Thank you for listening to Extended. See you next time.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
Absolutely. They're saying it is just the best thing you can do with your trousers on.
And it's goodbye from me as well. Thank you to listen. Thank you too. You're going to have to edit that bit, Peter. Thank you for listening to Extended. See you next time.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.